My name is Michael Stollard, and I'm the founder and president of Connection Culture Group. You can find out more about our work at connectionculture.com, and our latest book is called Connection Culture.
Michael Lee Stollard talking to you today about connection culture, but we're focusing today on how we face a labor shortage in this country. How hard is it to find workers, and why is this happening now?
Well, Pat, there are a number of factors. You know, it's being called the Great Resignation, that a lot of people coming out of the pandemic have reevaluated their lives and just the time that they spend commuting. They're also looking at, you know, what life was like during the pandemic and how they enjoyed reconnecting with family and friends in their community. Some people have decided to take early retirement. We also have seen just in recent years a high level of what's called job quits, just more people leaving the workforce. We have the factor of declining immigration, and so fewer people are coming in those that working age population years 16 to 64. Both fewer immigrants and also fewer people who are U.S. born in that age group. So all these factors are coming together, Pat, to reduce the number of people who are willing to work and who are available to work.
So you're not taking into account right now the crisis at the border and so many people flooding over the border when you talk about immigration?
Well, we've reduced immigration over recent years.
You know, legal.
So we're still catching up, right? Legal, yes. Immigration. You have to look at this on a sector-by-sector basis. So, for example, in sectors like science, technology, engineering, math, you know, what they call STEM, there are fewer people available than there are jobs. Or that's also true for, say, nursing or pilots. And that's one reason why we have a capacity issue with the airlines. All the domestic flights are packed right now,
yes,
because
mm-hmm.
they can't bring pilots into the workforce fast enough, mm-hmm. or hospitality workers. They're just across a wide range of industries. Almost every industry now is facing some part of their business where they don't have enough workers available to fit what they need.
And also, you alluded to this earlier, there are so many people who don't want to, quote unquote, put up with what they have to put up with in the workforce up until now. They just don't want to put up with it.
So that's true, Pat. You know, the Gallup organization that probably has the most data on this worldwide, and they've noted in their most recent report that negative emotions in the workplace have been rising for years. And let me just share a couple data points. Now, this data is from the U.S. and Canada combined, and 57% of employees report that they experience stress on a daily basis. 48% report feeling worried on a daily basis. 26% report feeling sadness on a daily basis. And 22%, Pat, report that they experience anger on a daily basis. So those are alarming numbers, just that negative emotions are high and people are struggling with that. And so it's no surprise that unless we make changes to bring, you know, diminish negative emotions and boost positive emotions in the workplace, it should be no surprise that people are not going to want to come back to the workplace.
So how do we deal with this? I know you mentioned, of course, the tried and true way, which is throwing some more money at them and or benefits. You go beyond this and you talk about emotional compensation.
Think of financial compensation and benefits as economic compensation. But what we're seeing in studying employees and really understanding what they're looking for is, of course, they're looking for to make more money and better benefits. That's always nice. But it's not enough. They also want their human needs to be met. And we're seeing in all these negative emotions that they're experiencing in the workplace, a desire to eliminate those and to experience more positive emotions. And to understand that, we really have to go back to what are human needs in the workplace. And in our work, we've boiled it down to 7, which is respect, recognition, belonging, autonomy, personal growth, meaning, and progress. And I explain it this way. When you first join a group, you expect to be respected. If you're not respected, you feel pain from that, and it's hard to do your best work. As you're there longer, you expect to receive some recognition. If you don't get some recognition for good work you're doing, you wonder. You start to feel insecure. Does anybody mm-hmm. even see the good work I'm doing? You're there longer, you hope to develop friendships, people whose backs you have and who have your backs. It has to go both ways. You want to have the autonomy to do your job. You don't want to be micromanaged all the time. you want to learn and grow. You know, that's a personal growth, mm-hmm. you know, to stretch and improve your skills. You want meaning, to know that your work is making a difference in a positive way to people. And you want to see progress in your work. When those needs are met, Pat, people describe it as, I feel connected. I feel connected to my work. I feel connected to my colleagues. I feel connected to my supervisor. I feel connected to my organization. And those connections help us thrive. When those connections are met, it meets those needs that I listed, the 7 universal human needs at work.
But that sounds like a utopia, and it's the influence of the leader on a workplace if you have a positive work culture. But, you know, in reading about all these nice things that could happen with a good leader, how can you make a kind leader? Because I think it stems from kindness, doesn't it? And everything else flows from that. Many people, either they're not kind to begin with, or they've had it beaten out of them or drummed mm-hmm. out of them over the years. So they're not in the position to be a good and kind leader. Your thoughts?
Sure. There is the utopian leader who's perfect, right? There are no leaders who are absolutely perfect. And all the leaders I've profiled who are amazing, wildly successful leaders, they're not perfect, but they're much closer toward perfection than those leaders who are at the opposite end. And that's it, is just figuring out what can we do to improve? And the pattern we see, Pat, is that leaders who communicate a vision that connects and unites people, that everybody can get behind, they value people as individuals and don't think or treat them as mere means to an end. Of course, you know, they're there to work, they're there for a purpose, mm-hmm. but they care about them as individuals. And they also give them a voice to express their opinions. And those leaders have the humility to know that they don't have monopoly on good ideas, that if they seek the opinions and ideas of the people they work with, that they're responsible for leading, they get ideas that will help them make better decisions. And if they give those people credit, what we call the specter of a vision, value, voice, is how we summarize it. And when people have vision, value, voice in their work culture, and their leaders are orchestrating that type of culture, they feel connected. They're more enthusiastic. They're more energetic. They give more effort, what we call employee engagement. And they align their behavior with the leader and the team's goals because they want the team to succeed.
And how do you get a leader to engage like that?
Well, you know, certainly there are those leaders who are controlling personalities, but I find that most leaders that I've coached, they want to create an environment where people thrive. They want to be successful.
Sure.
And they do care about people. They don't always know how to show it. And so one of the things we do as coaches and consultants is really help them understand, what are some specific actions I can take so that people will know that I care? They have a lot of pressure to perform. And so there's that constant performance anxiety that they're experiencing. But if you can help them and coach them, let me just give you a couple examples. Number one, investing the time to get to know, for each of the people you're responsible for leading, you know, what are their hopes and their careers? What type of work environment brings out the best in them? What can I do as a supervisor to help you do your best work? Taking the time to do that. And then secondly, getting to know more about the people they're responsible for leading in terms of their personal lives. So, you know, and there's research on this path that shows personal knowledge improves cooperation and collaboration in the workplace. So my favorite question to ask supervisors to ask is, you know, what are your interests outside of work? And learn more about their life outside of work. And just taking time to show that you are interested in them. It has to be sugar, as they say in the South. It can't be saccharine. It has to be the real thing. You have to genuinely have some interest in learning about them. And when you do, and you show that you care, it connects you and it helps them perform, give their best performance.
I had a boss once who talked about management by walking around. And he was seen. He walked around and he would sometimes give advice as needed, but he was present. He wasn't hiding in his office or off on another floor at a meeting all the time, as so many of them are. But he was there, and it really worked. Something as simple as that.
They learn how to be comfortable with people and actually enjoy connecting with people. And I remember I was talking to Jim Goodnight, who co-founded SAS Institute. And Jim's a very introverted scientist. But he, early on, when he was leading SAS Institute, he started going into the workplace and sitting down with groups of employees that he didn't know in the SAS Institute cafeteria. That's really hard for an introvert.
Sure.
But he was intentional about developing his ability to connect with employees. And then he set up these, what they call Java with Jim sessions, where he would just show up. They would serve coffee and soft drinks. And it was just connecting and mixing with people and answering their questions. Or I think of Howard Bihar, who's a friend. And Howard was the president of Starbucks. He was the first president of Starbucks International. And he had what he called open sessions, where he just traveled around the country and answered people's questions. And he's so approachable. And he's a safe person to ask anything.
Wow.
And so doing those little things, getting out and connecting with people, that's important. And I would go beyond that. I would also, I advise leaders to have what I call knowledge flow sessions, which is, what are the issues that are on your mind as a leader? Well, don't just process them yourself. Get out with your team and share some of those issues you're thinking about. And I call it putting your cards on the table. What are you thinking about them? And then ask people, first of all, share that you know you don't have a monopoly on ideas and you want to get the best thinking. So ask them what's right, what's wrong, what's missing from your thinking, and just be quiet and listen. Write down what you hear, take notes, and implement the good ideas and give people credit for suggesting them. And you would be amazed at the impact something like that had. You'll make better decisions because you'll learn things. People will feel more connected to you. They'll feel more connected to the organization. And it really boosts these emotional compensation benefits that will help people want to stay in the workplace rather than leave. And then as your reputation gets out, it'll attract more workers.
Labor, we've been reading about how because of the shortage of workers and people dissatisfied and leaving the workplace, labor seems to be, for the first time in a long time, getting a little bit of the upper hand. So it would seem, if you extrapolate from that, that leaders should really start paying attention because this could be labor's moment.
Yes, there's definitely, you know, power is moving from employers to employees. You know, you think of, say, pilots as an extreme example. There's capacity is almost full in the U.S. now in terms of domestic airline capacity because they can't get enough pilots in. And, you know, there are some who have retired. They don't want to go back.
Yeah.
So there's this shift going on, and we're going to see this for a number of years now. So it's important for organizations to really nurture and develop cultures that connect people, cultures of connection, rather than cultures that are disconnecting because they're over-controlling or they're just indifferent to these emotional needs that people have. And, you know, I point out one good example is Costco. It's a company yes. that, in fact, there, I remember asking Jim Sinegal, the co-founder of Costco, Jim, you know, how would you describe your culture? And he told me it's, you know, we describe our culture as do the right thing. That just means that at Costco, they obey the law. They take care of their members, which is their customers. They take care of their employees. They respect their suppliers and they reward their shareholders in that order. And by taking care of their employees, you know, they pay them above average compensation, above average benefits. But they also, everything they do there provides emotional benefits to their employees. They have a mentoring apprenticeship-like system to help employees learn and grow. They've never not given their employees raises, even during difficult times. And they are very respectful. You know, they, if you don't respect people in that culture, you won't stay there. Mm-hmm. You just won't last. It's such a part of that culture. And so no surprise that they have employee retention rates. They're the envy of all their competitors. So they've been wildly successful at retaining employees for many years. And it's no surprise because the economic benefits are there, but also the emotional compensation is there as well.
I'm interested to hear what you think about a possible rise in discrimination in these times. I think it's hard enough to get ahead in normal times without bosses doing the safe thing and hiring and not hiring anybody who's different. They just hire people who are like them. Or on the other hand, maybe this is the time that leaders will, quote unquote, take a chance and broaden their horizons when it comes to hiring workers.
Well, I think because we do find ourselves in this labor shortage situation, Pat, that we will see leaders going out and hiring maybe people who are not like them. You know, they'll be willing to put up with differences. And that's good. It'll create opportunities. But it has to go further than that. They have to create a work environment where everybody needs to feel connected to their supervisor, to the people they work with, to their organization, irrespective of their differences, whether it's race, gender, what have you. And that means leaders are going to have to be more intentional about cultivating these cultures of connection that connect with people who, you know, the dominant culture has historically been white male. Mm-hmm. And so people who are in non-dominant subcultures, you know, whether it's women or people of color or whatever difference there is versus the dominant culture, they need to feel connected too. And our human nature is the more people we supervise, research shows that the less sensitive we become to the needs of the average employee. And so the most successful leaders remain sensitive to and stay connected with employees so that they understand what those emotional benefits are in the culture. You know, they're creating a culture where people can thrive. Does provide these this emotional compensation or emotional benefits because it's meeting those seven needs that I talked about. So I'm encouraged that I think we will see more opportunities for people, whether they're people of color or women. So that'll be good. But it has to be met with cultures that help them feel connected, or it's ultimately not going to be successful.
That's optimistic. I like to end on that note. Anything else you want to add, Michael, before we conclude?
Well, I'm optimistic, Pat. I feel that coming out of this pandemic, people's need for connection, it's a felt need now. It's stronger than it's ever been, I would say, in my lifetime. And that presents an opportunity for organizations to be intentional about cultivating cultures of connection. And we're just seeing so much demand right now. I think organizations recognize, and they're using the word connection, which, you know, we've seen in recent years that artists were using the word connection. I think of the song by One Republic, Connection, or things on Broadway. You know, Hamilton, for example, part of the Hamilton's theme is feeling connected. Or Dear Evan Hansen, you know, a boy in high school who experiences social pain and longs for connection. So artists have their finger on the pulse of culture, and they've been increasing this message of longing for connection for years. And now coming out of the pandemic, it's a broad felt need. I think that's an opportunity for organizations and leaders to be more intentional about cultivating cultures that will bring out the best in people. And that's cultures that make them feel connected.
Well, that was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. I love talking to you. And I'm glad we're doing it more often than we were. So
it's an interesting time we're in.